You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, July 16th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times
building in the fashionable Dalla. Oh,
Michael
building.
Screwed it
Sorry.
Up. I'm doing it right, and Michael
Whatever.
Screwed it up.
Whatever. In the fashionable Dalla Lunch District of New York City, on today's program, Saba Ahmed. She's the Muslim GOP activist who was attacked at the Benghazi conspiracy panel a couple of weeks ago. I want to talk with her about being a Muslim in the GOP and some of the bigger issues surrounding that. It will be an inquiry, maybe a little bit of a debate. There's a number of questions I have for her about that. Also, Rachel Kurzes will be joining Matt to talk about the new Planet of the Apes film.
Yes,
and before you roll your eyes and tune out, it's about how that movie is an allegory of the shock doctrine. That's going to be fascinating. Also, no ceasefire in Gaza. I'm going to explain to you what Hamas is demanding in order for a ceasefire to happen. The broader context of the ceasefire. Also, ethnic cleansing selfies. And
Ethnic cleansing selfies.
I'll explain to you. That's a really disturbing, sick story. I'll explain to you what it means later in the program. Also, Bob Beckel, who you may never have even heard of, the drunk contributor on The Five, the Democrat on Fox News.
The Democrat
has some interesting thoughts about Chinamen. And I enjoyed this sound so much that I'm just going to need to play it for you. And I guess pretend I'm a drunk Bob Beckel negotiating with a Chinese prostitute for a little while.
Also coming up in the better half, Chris Christie's made an anti-union movie trailer, but he's since taken it down. I wonder why. Archie, the comic book character, conservatives are really pissed about something having to do with him. We'll find out what that's all about. And KKK is trying to recruit people by handing out candy. That and more coming up to you as the show rolls on.
So, folks, we got a little bit of a late start today, obviously. So we
had some internet issues in the office.
Yeah, we really...
Time for us to get a new internet service provider.
Definitely time for us to get a new internet service provider. It's been kind of a nightmare. So we're going to take a brief break, listen to some great musical stylings, and we'll be right back with Saba Ahmed. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Whoops.
We're not going to be doing
no,
that.
No, we will. I just forgot to shut the other song off.
Whoa.
Here we go.
A little bit of a hiccup here, folks. All right.
One stage, one person front, my face on the front page. Only if I had one love, one girl and one crib, one God to show me how to do things his son did. Pure, like a cup of virgin blood, mixed with 151. One sip would probably make me flip. See my name in the hieroglyphs, like Osiris and Isis. Parables written inside papyruses, acknowledge it. We've been all tricked, time to come out of it. Seeds watch us, grow up and try to follow us. Police watch us, roll up and try knocking us. One knee I duck, could it be my time is up? With my luck, I got up. The cop picking. Bus stop glass bursts. A fiend drops a Heineken. Ricocheting between the spots that I'm hiding in. Black it out as I duck back. Forget getting hit. This is my hood. I'm a rep to the death of it. To everybody, come on. Little brothers is grown. The rats don't abortion your wound. We need more warriors soon. Sit from the stars, sun, and the moon. And it's life of police chases, street sweepers, and coppers. Stick up kids with no conscience. Leave
one pen, one prayer.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
And I am Michael Brooks. And joining us now is Saba Ahmed, who made headlines a couple of weeks ago when she was at the Benghazi panel at the Heritage Foundation. And was and the controversy that arose from that, which we've certainly covered on this show and many other outlets covered it as well. She's also a Republican Muslim activist. Saba, thanks for joining us. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me.
It's good to have you on. So I want to situate this conversation by giving.
So I look forward to.
Sorry.
I look forward to sharing my insights, and I apologize that your voice is breaking up, but I will try my best.
How is this now, Saba? We could call you right back if it's a problem.
This is fine.
This is fine? Okay. All right, yeah. Then let's go, and if there's any problem, just let me know, and we'll reestablish the line. Look, before I want to get into some questions, broader questions about how you kind of reconcile these identities and what your conception of the modern Republican Party and how being a Muslim would fit into that. And, you know, certainly this show has a very progressive perspective. And part of that is definitely being cognizant and aware of Islamophobia domestically in the United States and then how that actually overlaps with problems in U.S. foreign policy. So we've covered what happened to you at the Benghazi panel in that context. But we've also, you know, had some critical questions that I want to get to as well. But before we get to all of that, I want to give you a forum to just kind of briefly explain what brought you to the Republican Party, what speaks to you about it, and how does that align and complement your identity as a Muslim American?
Sure. Well, first of all, I was a Democrat for several years, and I was very active in Democratic politics in Oregon. And I decided to become a Republican after I ran for office. And it was primarily because during the campaign, I was constantly asked about candidate positions and during candidate debates and questions. And I found it very hard to justify a lot of the Democratic Party platform values because they conflicted with my religious belief. And
would you get specific about that, Saba?
In terms of, like, specifically, like, it was hard to justify, like, the pro-choice stuff. Mm-hmm. It was the LGBT. I mean, some of the things were so, like, fundamental to, like, religion. A lot of people asked me, well, Islam says this. Why are you advocating this? And then, like, you know, I did a lot of soul searching afterwards, and then I kind of, at least from, the basic perspective, I just thought, it aligned better with the Republicans, even though it was not exactly a very welcoming experience in the beginning for me. And even to this day, we continue to have our challenges within the Republican Party, but generally, I feel like, at least Islamically, the values in terms of the pro-life and the pro-business, pro-family values, traditional marriage, that sort of stuff aligned a little bit better with the Republican Party platform.
Right. So and we're going to get more into that. What about but following on your thinking and the issues that you value? So, sure, I would imagine if you're not a supporter of marriage equality and you don't support reproductive access, and I think being business friendly, I think that gets very ambiguous what we actually mean by that and how that's defined. But obviously, that's certainly at least rhetorically a strong part of the Republican rhetoric and framing. Foreign policy and issues ranging from Guantanamo to drone strikes fit in? Because I would imagine being sensitive to those issues, having a lot of dissatisfaction with both parties and both, certainly Bush and Obama administrations from the perspective of those issues.
Of course. I mean, that's my main, I'm very passionate about national security issues. Mm-hmm. That's been my issue because I feel like a lot of the anti-Muslim rhetoric has translated into domestic and foreign policies that have been hurting our economy, our country. And I think it's if we just kind of started talking to each other, we would solve a lot of problems. Muslim Americans have generally been sidelined and demonized. And for a long time, even prior to 9/11, a lot of Muslims were Republicans, but a lot of them switched or stopped getting involved in politics because of the negative targeting of our leadership. Mm-hmm. And so obviously, like you just maybe have heard about the NSA surveillance and targeting for the last, 2001 to 2010, and I mean, even now there's a lot still going on. I mean, even though President Obama changed, it didn't change the people who were running the counterterrorism operations. There, a lot of the stuff is still the same. And I just feel like we need to be able to have a very basic perspective. We never diagnosed the problems. Root causes of terrorism were never addressed. If there was ideological differences, we could have addressed them through moderate Muslims, which are 99% of peace. Are a peaceful people, and we've been living in this country for a long time, and I think we should have been involved in those policy discussions, but sadly we were kicked out, or for whatever reason we were never on the table.
So I just have go ahead, Saba, complete your thought.
I just hope that, the reason I got involved more in the Republican side is because I feel like I'm usually the only Muslim there, first of all, in a lot of Republican circles, and I just feel like I'm the only one speaking to the Republicans about national security issues from a Muslim perspective, and I just hope that, I think we need to work with both parties, obviously, but I think Republicans really do need to have a voice from within as well to address this.
Yeah, and I when you said that 99% of Muslims are moderate, it was really hard for me to not break into my Brigitte Gabrielle impression, but I restrained myself because I thought that might be traumatic for you to hear. But it's a pretty good impression, actually, I have to say, if I say so myself. So that all makes sense. So this is where, though, there's a number of things you mentioned that I think, this is where I have a critique and concerns about how this has played out. So when I first saw that video of the Heritage mm-hmm. Foundation, I mean, it's shocking and it's appalling. And frankly, I mean, if you have, any familiarity, which I'm sure you do, with Frank Gaffney as an example or Brigitte Gabrielle, you know that it's an industry of peddling conspiracy theories. It's not just a debate about particular foreign policy methodologies, which is problematic enough. But it's also, Huma Abedin is a secret Muslim Brotherhood agent. President Obama is, putting Muslim seals on podiums at the State Department or the White House. I mean, it's very demented, very conspiratorial, very bizarre stuff mm-hmm. that comes out of a lot of these places. And frankly, I would expect nothing else at a Benghazi panel at the Heritage Foundation. So I think in some respects, I mean, it was mm-hmm. appalling, but it was in no way surprising. So I kind of wanted to get, your sense of what your actual surprise level was, because to me it was entirely expected seeing that clip. And then I guess,
for me it was really odd because I didn't actually expect that type of reaction. I have been to so many conservative, I've been to Heritage panels before too, and I've been in DC for about a year and a half, and I regularly go to think tank events and sometimes ask questions, and I've never been personally attacked in that way. I've had tough answers and stuff, or people who have avoided to answer the questions, but just never had that type of a response. But at the same time, for me, it was a first time experience because I had heard so much about Brigitte Gabrielle and Frank Gaffney. And I actually, that day, it was such a last minute issue because I had some other friends that wanted to go. And I was like, no, I won't be able to go. And it was very last minute that I was I had another meeting canceled. So then I was like, okay, I will go attend. And then I went there, and then I was just from the moment I walked in, Brigitte Gabrielle was so upset seeing a Muslim there, and I just was like, I knew something was going to happen. I just had that
70%. I'm sorry. I couldn't resist. Go ahead.
Well, anyways, so yeah, but and then I was like, okay, well, and then the whole time, like, you know, I just feel like they were talking, this conversation needs to happen. They're always blaming Islamist terrorists for all our problems, and so apparently, but we haven't bothered to talking to any people who follow Islam. And so I just felt like, and then the more I talk to these people, the more I'm surprised that they haven't had even basic conversations with Muslims. And a lot of the Islamophobia network that has been operating since 9/11 have, like, you know, they've chosen these so-called experts who apparently lived in the Middle East for a little bit and then came here, and now they're experts on Islam.
Oh, if even. I mean, many of them have absolutely no type of, I would say, even sophisticated amateur expertise. But I mean,
I know, exactly. But it's so funny because, like, when you actually challenge them, then they are like, then they have no response. Like, then if you start talking about the Quran, or if I open the Quran and start talking about the peaceful verses, then they really get upset, because then they're like, they don't know what to do because their whole strategy falls apart. Because they've been condemning the, you know, the taking some verses out of context about the laws of war and then using them against all Muslims.
But Saba, this is where. So, I agree with you, and on one level, being clear, I mean, I support. Everybody should be able, obviously, to have the politics they want to have, the religion they want to have, to participate in public life the way they want to, and. You know, it's probably a good thing. I mean, it's a good thing, especially because you're within Republican circles and you're challenging these narratives. You're not, you know, reinforcing and feeding them, which frankly would be a very lucrative and easy position for you to assume, to be the person at the panel in Islamic garb talking about how Islam is a threat would be a great marketing niche. So I appreciate, you know, very much what you're doing. But where I have criticism, I guess, is in two distinct ways. So one is, you know, okay, so I understand from a personal religious perspective, whatever beliefs you may or may not have about marriage equality, as an example. But I think that clearly, you know, there is one line in American thinking, obviously, and this has implications for how we relate to something like Islamophobia or religious freedom. You know, there was the Kennedy example. Or, you know, the example followed by probably more people in liberal or democratic politics, which is that regardless of what my religious or my faith may inform my values, my sense of creating justice, but it is not going to inform my kind of civil view of civil rights in America for groups writ large. So I may have this or that belief, but fundamentally, I know I need to distinguish that from how I engage in a civil society, how I engage in policymaking. Now, the Republican Party has clearly, and as you say, they have not made those distinctions. And it just strikes me that it's very hard to expect then for it to be disaggregated. Because if some, you know, if there is a Republican figure who's saying, I don't support marriage equality, and I don't support a certain, you know, health access for women, as an example, then by that same logic, they may have a bigoted or religiously informed view of Islam, and they may also think that America has a specifically Christian character, and therefore it's not a debate about, you know, a mosque at Ground Zero is not a question of religious freedom. It's a question of the right religion and the wrong religion, and who gets privileged and who doesn't get privileged. And it seems to me that once you enter into politics from that perspective, regardless of what's motivating it, you're opening the door for exactly what you're objecting to. And I will finish very briefly because I'm giving you a lot to deal with. But, you know,
hello.
Hi, Saba. Hello.
Hey, I am so sorry.
What happened?
The call got dropped, and I've been trying to call you guys back, and I was on the whole line.
Oh, that's so funny. I've been trying you. Do you have another line on right now?
No, sorry, I had your radio show on. So I was
listening. Okay, no problem.
I had a feeling that's what it was.
I was wondering.
There's
what was going on.
Yeah, let's continue.
No,
the interview.
Sorry, I would never hang up on you. It was not my fault. I don't know what happened to the phone. It hung up.
Oh,
I was on the hold line. I left you a few messages as well.
Oh, no. Okay, no problem. I don't know. Technology is what it is. And we've been having. I would like to sick Brigitte Gabrielle on our internet service provider because they are a threat. to national security and to small business. But let me finish this question because we are running low on time, and thank you so much for your patience. So I guess the question that I was trying to set up was that if you are using the frame of applying a certain religious framework to guide policy that may lead to an exclusion of rights of certain groups, like the LGBT community as an example.
I understand. Actually, I did want to address, like, you know, I support, like, civil rights movements and stuff. And obviously, we live in – this is not, like, an Islamic country, so I'm not imposing my views on anybody. But I just found it hard for myself to advocate for those positions. That's the only reason I switched. But in terms of, like, obviously we have many members of the LGBT community who are, you know, who have been good friends of mine for a long time and are very active in Oregon politics that know me very well, too, that I have been, like, you know, supportive. But in terms of just personally in my, like, you know, as you know, in Islam, it's not allowed. So for me, I can't support it religiously. But at the same time, I live in America. As an American, I support their civil rights to do. You know, have equal rights or equal protection under the law.
Well, and I just – Matt has a quick question for you, but I just want to – it's important to acknowledge that I think, you know, and I'm not a Muslim, but I think as in all faith communities, there is debate within these faith communities about those issues. And there is, you know, that's not necessarily, you know, I mean, I understand, you know, what you're saying clearly, but it's not necessarily universally the case. But Matt, go ahead, ask your question.
My question is, I completely understand why you left the Democratic Party and your feelings. And I think it's really there should be more people out there who have the view that they don't agree with something, but they realize they live in a country where that's okay and they just don't want to be involved with it. That's fine. But my question is, why the Republican Party, though? Why not just leave the Democratic Party and advocate for views that aren't with not even maybe independent or with another party that's more in line with your views that isn't just so blatantly attacking people of the Islamic faith? It's just bizarre to me that you would join the Republican Party because of those reasons when the Republican Party is, to me, more so against the bigger picture, which is your faith.
Well, that's exactly what I'm trying to address. But we live in the United States, and we do even though we may not like it, we do have a two-party system, like in terms of the majority of political influence. If we really want change, it has to be through one of those two parties. And so as hard as my road might be to work with the Republicans, to work, you know, trying to get them to stop hating Muslims, trying to maybe, you know, get to more peaceful terms and maybe getting them to like us, and maybe in the next decade or so they won't be as harsh, and maybe I'll personally talk to every single Republican who hates Muslims and maybe change their views, I don't know. But I think, you know, that's what we need to do. And I, as much as I'd like to, you know, think that if I become libertarian or independent or any other party, it's not going to be as effective. And personally, like, you know, as a Muslim, I would love to reach out to all faiths, all groups, everybody, whoever has issues with Muslims. And especially right now, as we face the national security situation domestically and internationally, we need to work with all sides. But at the same time, I personally feel I think I can be more effective in the Republican circles because that voice is missing right now.
But Saba, I guess, I mean, we do need to wrap up very soon. But I think, I mean,
sure.
The other question that I would have for you, I mean, there's two things, though, that are kind of, I mean, they reinforce what Matt said. And I wonder, I mean, and you know, take this in two parts, obviously. But one thing is that another aspect of that we cover a lot on this show is the aspect of modern Republican politics that is really like a scam, basically. You know, like the game of email newsletters and inside investment tips and all of these different scams and conspiracy theories and ways of making money off of an inbuilt audience. And it just strikes me that, you know, I don't doubt that some of these people are, you know, their fears and bigotry towards Islam is quite genuine to the extent that that's a positive thing. But I think that there's a whole other market of people, just as there's a market for people with, you know, You know, like Alex Jones sells crazy health supplements. Other people sell crazy Islam conspiracy theories. You know, that there's a market for this in the Republican Party that goes beyond just a genuine – like it's not on a level. It's not like, oh, well, come and explain your faith to us. It's we have a market incentive and a market interest in not having Islam be presented in a rational and fair way in the United States. And I guess the second part I just – really briefly, I mean, you know, you're looking at the crisis on the border right now, and we've been very critical of President Obama. Not, you know, that issue needs to be reframed. I mean, these kids are fleeing horrific. I mean, it's a refugee situation, and the response of the right. Republican Party is throw these kids back to situations where they quite literally, like the likelihood of them getting raped, murdered, forced into child soldier situations for essentially mafia cartels, is like that's the likely outcome. And the level of dehumanization implicit in that position is really astounding. So I really wonder, both when you look at the full scale of the kind of scam built around Islamophobia and other things, and just the relentless concern and fear-mongering about the other, whatever that form may take, whether Muslim, LGBT, or a child who's struggled to get here from El Salvador, I don't know how you really break that. And at a certain point, I wonder if you get so morally repulsed, why would you want to try to break it?
Well, obviously, like, you know, we do have our concerns, but I mean, the border crisis is a huge issue, and I mean, it's going to get worse with the DACA, and I'm not sure exactly, like, it's just a crisis that I don't think anybody was expecting in Washington. But I was actually in McAllen, Texas a few months ago. I have good friends there. But we really do need to seriously have a humanitarian perspective on this issue. I think the Pope recently issued another statement. I think the conservative movement needs to look at the Christian values as well. He talked about welcoming strangers, welcoming kids, and, like, you know, providing them with a home and, you know, having a very basic humanitarian perspective. And we need to bring that back to Republican politics, because fundamentally that's what the party was about. It was about the Christian values, and so if that's what we represent, I think that's what we need to do. It's going to take time. I mean, there's a lot of hatred and animosity towards, you know, immigrants or anybody who's not, you know, in their worldview. But I think more immigrants need to have their voices in the Republican Party. And as it goes forward, I think minorities will get that voice with our increasing voting power and stuff. So hopefully it'll make a difference.
Well, Saba Ahmed, we actually do have to run. But I will just say, I'm being blunt, I'm dubious about the success you'll have in the modern Republican Party. But I will say, if they followed your communications advice, they would probably run some more effective campaigns and be a little bit more difficult for us to beat. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for coming on.
Sure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot.
All right, folks. Yeah, sorry about the jumble today.
I'm glad we called her back, because I truly believe there was a phone issue, because it was just a bizarre place of
– Yeah, no, it made total sense. I've just never had that happen before. I didn't realize she was trying to call in. All right, folks, we're going to take a very brief break. Matt's going to come back at you with Rachel Kurzies. This is going to be a fun one. And then we will switch back and get to the fun half. And thanks, as always, for joining us on – an Eminem Wednesday. I think I'm sophisticated, because I'm living my life like a good homo sapien. But all around me, everybody's multiplying, and they're walking around like flies, man. So I'm no better than the animal city. I'm so educated and I'm so civilized, cause I'm a strict vegetarian. But with the overpopulation and inflation and starvation and the crazy politicians, I don't feel safe in this world, no more.
Sam's mic up. You could bring down the one next to Sam's computer. Michael's get. You have to put Matt up for you to talk.
Oh, you have the board all confusing over here, buddy.
I don't have the board in your own little system.
It makes sense. Anyways, we're back.
Because I'm usually sitting there, so that's why it's labeled.
Yeah. Whatever. Go ahead, buddy.
All right. Well. Joining us now, Rachel Curzius. She's a radio producer at SiriusXM and a film and theater critic. And we're going to be talking Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Rachel, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's an honor to be with you, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here. Let's talk about this movie because I saw I saw Dawn of the Planet of the Apes this past weekend. I saw Rise of the Planet of the Apes when it came out in 2011, and I've seen all five of the original Planet of the Apes. I guess it's not a trilogy because it's more than three, but everyone knows what I'm talking about. The franchise.
Yeah,
Planet
the
of
franchise,
the Apes.
Precisely.
Yes. And I just got to say, this past one, most people are just going to think it's just another summer blockbuster movie. You know, it came out in July. It's a movie about apes and humans going to war, for God's sakes. We got apes on tanks, apes riding horses, apes firing assault rifles. It seems like it would just be one of those action-packed, Michael Bay-esque summer films. But it is way more than that, and it is certainly worth everyone's look. Everyone should go see this movie. And Rachel's going to tell us a little bit why.
Yeah, exactly, Matt. I think you nailed it. I mean, nobody expected this movie to be any good. I mean, essentially, it's a prequel sequel to a reboot of an old franchise, which really sounds like the satire of what the Hollywood greenlighting process for blockbusters is these days. So nobody expected to really sit down and have this, like, really thoughtful film that forces you to ruminate. But, you know, since I saw the movie, and I actually saw it only yesterday, I can't get it out of my mind. I mean, to me, so, you know, to set the scene, this is 10 years after Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And what has happened is most humans have died off thanks to this simian flu. And the apes at the last film who escaped at the end of the film are now living in your woods. And they've created their own society there.
There's thousands of them now.
Yes. Exactly. They've established this incredible seeming society for themselves. So as a quick aside, I mean, you know, the only issue I took with the society is they have this whole group of diverse apes and orangutans and stuff making decisions. But where were the lady apes there to be talking? All the only lady ape I saw was literally giving birth.
You're right.
Movie. Yeah, so that's probably my one beef with this otherwise kind of radical ape vision for what society could look like. But to me, it was this environment of mutual distrust, right? So you have the apes in the woods, and then a fledgling human society trying to reestablish itself. And the way it can do that is through a power generating station in those same woods. So the question for the lead ape becomes, does he help the humans? And the lead ape is this dude, Caesar, played by Andy Serkis, a.k.a. Green Extraordinaire.
Yes.
And, I mean, just for a second, I mean, that dude is incredible.
If you've seen a primarily CGI character on screen, it's most likely, and it's really well done and human-like, and the acting and emotions in the CGI character are phenomenal, then it's likely played by, the CGI character is likely played by Andy Serkis.
Yeah, exactly. Of Gollum fame, who, you know, I mean, he made Gollum seem more human than most. So that was impressive. But I mean, so as Caesar, he has kind of a more kindly disposition towards humans than most of the other apes who were actually, you know, in labs, had been tortured by humans, really saw humans as violent and kind of had that violence engendered in them. And so Caesar has these negotiations with the humans over whether they can use this power station, and you really see there that this kind of the downside of any sort of peaceful negotiations, right? Because if the humans then decide to attack, Caesar looks weak, he looks stupid, he looks like he should have attacked first, which is something that felt really bleak to me. You know what I mean?
It was, yes,
like there's such a downside for trying to kind of diplomatically engage with others rather than immediately go towards attacking. Which I found so fascinating. And, you know, and then I don't want to kind of spoil it for your audience because a lot of really genuinely shocking things happen. But at one point in the film, something shocking happens, kind of a very upsetting event that the apes are reeling from. And one ape takes advantage of that situation. And something that I thought really reminded me of Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
It really transformed that society from something peaceful to something seeking vengeance, where they essentially start a war with the humans.
Yes.
So to me, I mean, and I know that Naomi Klein is specifically kind of in her book, also called Shock Doctrine, she talks about economic policies, specifically libertarian policies, as something that will happen by kind of people at the top when societies are still reeling from a shocking event, kind of physically and emotionally. A huge example she uses is the Iraq War after September 11th. But you see here that, and I guess to me that's what was the most interesting about it, was watching these apes, who are, you know, also very intelligent and can speak English and stuff, deal with what it means to have to make all of these ethical considerations and trying to be different than humans. And figuring out kind of what that means.
Yeah, I mean, it really even in the beginning of the film, when you're listening to ape laws, there's a very important rule. It's the number one rule in their society, and it's ape does not kill ape. And
yeah,
they struggle with that even throughout the film. And it's a pretty important rule for them. So for them to have to struggle with that in this storyline that pulls through, it sort of brings home that, you know, maybe, you know, they're not so different from the humans and vice versa. There's also a scene that echoes the first of the reboot series, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, where instead of it's Caesar going no and defending himself, it's a human going no and defending another human from an ape.
Yes. Oh, my God. I loved that. Yeah. I mean, did that first scene where you kind of see it written in almost like a childish-looking font, where it said ape no kill ape, it reminded me a little bit of Animal Farm. You know,
it's
like all animals are equal, and then later on it's, but some are more equal than others. And in that same way, it's ape do not kill ape, but we kind of get to decide what it means to be an ape. And if you're no longer an ape the way we perceive of it, then, you know, maybe we can kill you. It's kind of the complexities that come with building, you know, a complex society that needs to accommodate difficult situations and negotiations and stuff like that. It was really, really fascinating to watch what seems at the beginning like an idyllic play. I mean, I would have loved to live in that ape society, kind of turn to turmoil when they're faced with these really difficult ethical quandaries.
I mean, you brought up the it's the main issue of the film, but we're not going to do any spoilers here, but the power supply, and it's the apes who have to have this internal debate with themselves of whether they should allow the humans to get the lights back on. That's how they phrase it, get the lights back on. And
right.
And the apes who don't want to help the humans point out that if we do this, it could lead to peace, but at the same time, if it doesn't, the humans will have the lights back. They'll have power again, which makes them a bigger threat than they are right now. And I mean, we see this with issues today in actual society today where certain countries try to control other countries because, God forbid, they get this power that they don't want to use for certain reasons, maybe, but if they do get this power, they can.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and this idea of resources, and people think the reason why the apes are so much stronger than us is because they don't rely on resources. They can kind of exist in the wild without all of these other things that we depend on, like light, like, you know, running water, all those sorts of things. So, you know, how do you, I guess, create a society that is as minorly dependent on those external factors as possible? And, you know, I guess, you know, as humans, maybe we were supposed to be siding with the humans, but I really took to the apes' point that if they gave the humans this power generator, what could happen is the humans establish themselves and start encroaching further and
yes.
further and further and begin. So you could really sense that even if things in this generation are good, they could get worse for their children.
Yes.
And that really seems like a menace where, you know, knowing human society seems like a really legitimate concern.
I do have to say, I don't think it's weird at all siding for the apes in these movies, because I think actually something's wrong with you if you're rooting for the humans in the Planet of the Apes movies.
I totally agree.
One thing about this rebooted series, it's not technically even a reboot, which this is more on the film side of things than talking the broader political themes of the movie. But if you enjoy the original series, this is actually not technically a full-on reboot. They're not trying to retell the original Planet of the Apes movies. They're actually making these as a standalone prequel to the original Planet of the Apes, which means you can be able to – while they are borrowing themes, and there's a lot of – they pretty much said that this most recent one, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, pretty much borrows the theme from the last of the five Planet of the Apes – original Planet of the Apes movies, Battle of the Planet of the Apes. They can be watched in order when this rebooted series is completed. So I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it is really cool. And, you know, and I think that what I like about them doing a prequel to the old films is that then we can all kind of collectively forget about the Mark Wahlberg entry into the series.
Oh, that's forgotten already. No one remembers that one, yeah. No, but I mean...
Yeah, what movie?
I think that is important because the original Planet of the Apes movies, like a lot of movies from that time that blew up huge, I mean, the original Planet of the Apes movies was also a social commentary. Unlike that one that came out in 2001, which was literally just some blockbuster reboot, let's make some money off of an established series. And I'm glad that they rebooted the series the right way, and they have people behind it who are not just watching the original Planet of the Apes movies as, oh, look, apes versus humans, what great cinematic scenes we'll get out of this. They're realizing there was a social message in those movies, a political message in those movies, and they're continuing with that theme.
Right. I mean, I think that maybe something that studios are picking up on is that people are interested in seeing something that is exciting and riveting, as this movie absolutely was, but also something that kind of leaves them with an affect of some kind, whatever it may be, something that leaves you with something to chew on when you're
yes.
done. And that's something I really enjoyed in this. I mean, you know, it's interesting because the humans at the beginning have essentially destroyed themselves, right? Like there was the simian flu, but really there were a lot of riots. Humans killed each other through violence and
yes.
fear. And the apes seem like the counterbalance, right? Here's what they call the family, this group of peaceful like apes who were, you know, living in harmony with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens when that harmony is disturbed? Can it ever be restored?
And,
or really are they going to end up just like the humans and destroy one another?
And the very end of the movie is going to, well, I'm not going to spoil it here, but it certainly sets the tone for the third one that's already publicly been announced. I think
I can't wait.
I mean, they've already established what that message is going to be in that final scene in this movie. And I think it's you got to check out this movie. And if me saying it isn't enough, then I refuse to believe Rachel didn't convince you. So
I loved it. And I promise I'm not getting paid by the studio or anything. This is entirely of my own volition that I'm just like plugging this movie because I think it's just fantastic.
You're not the only. I've seen tons of critics who have been saying this movie is not even just better than expected, but it's not just a summer blockbuster. It deserves way more than that. And I think I think you've given the case better than anyone, Rachel. Rachel Curzius, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Everyone, go see Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. All right, folks, we're going to go into the better half of the program. You can support this show by becoming a member at got a coughing fit now. You can support this show by becoming a member at majority.fm/become a member. MajorityApp.com to download the app. It's free. No reason you shouldn't download it. And if you already got it, no reason to not try to convince your friends and family members to download it as the perfect introduction to the Majority Report. You can also support this show by going to justcoffee.coop, where you get fair trade coffee and chocolates for a discount with the coupon code MAJORITY. And you can also support this show even more by going to MajorityReportKickback.com. That is our Amazon affiliate link. You can buy all your Amazon stuff for the same price you would get it at Amazon.com, except Amazon.com takes a little bit less money because they got to share the pie with us. Boo-hoo for Amazon. Yay for us. Let's do that up, folks. And Sam is en route to Netroots as we speak. For those tuning in today and may have missed yesterday's show, wondering where the hell Sam is on a Wednesday, that's where he is. He is en route to Netroots Nation, where he will be live tomorrow and Friday, bringing you great interviews from Netroots. We will be live, and we will see you in the... You're off.
Sorry. Do we have information yet on that meetup?
I do not know of any information. There's going to be a meeting at Netroots. The Young Turks have put it together because we're part of the Young Turks YouTube network. Our YouTube channel is, which is youtube.com/Sam Cedar, where you subscribe. Young Turks put it together. David Pakman will be there. Young Turks, Sam Cedar of the Majority Report will be there. We will get you that information as soon as we know about it. Probably won't get it by the time this show ends, but we'll put it up on the site, majority.fm. And even if we don't have it by then, we'll make sure we have it for you all.
And just and really, really, really quick too, folks, in addition to all the things you should do to link to the Majority Report, help us keep building the show, do what we do every day, and actually expand it, on the website today is a link. The comment period is going to be over pretty soon. I think this is the last week where you can
– Oh, Friday is the last day.
Friday is the last day that you can flood the FCC and tell them to protect net neutrality from their garbage proposal that would totally overturn net neutrality. So there's a link there for you. And I think actually the FCC website has crashed again recently with the amount of comments. So we got to keep the full court press on that. There's a link to it on today's blog.
I mean, there's nothing more important to the issue of whether or not alternative media will continue to grow in the coming years than the issue of net neutrality.
Huge.
Huge. All right, folks, we will see you in the better half.
We will see you.
Oh, you can call into the show, 646-257-3920. The IMs are open. The phone lines are opening right now. Talk to you in a minute. You have to put up my computer, which is right next to Sam's computer. That's the wrong one. Pilot light. That's pilot light. You want La Poupée. There we go.
Sorry, folks. A little sloppy.